This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hi, thanks for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today we really have a very special guest, Raoul Paul. In the early 90s, Raoul worked at Goldman and Sachs, where he co-managed the hedge fund sales business in equities and equity derivatives in Europe. He then co-managed the GLG Global Macro Fund in London for GLG Partners, one of the world's largest hedge funds. He retired from managing client money at age 34 in 2004, and since then he has founded Real Vision TV, the world's first on-demand TV channel for finance. Raoul has been publishing Global Macro Investor since 2005 to provide original, high-quality, quantifiable, and easy, readable research for the global macro investment community. Raoul, we really welcome you to our show and appreciate you taking the time today.
Not at all. I appreciate you asking me.
Most of our listeners are from the real estate world, so probably you would do us a favor by just describing what a global macro investor does.
Sure. So what I do is, if you imagine yourself as a real estate investor, that's your particular expertise. Other people have expertise in credit or stock markets or even sectors of stock markets. As a macro person, I look at the overall picture that's driven by the economies, the movement of economies over time, and how that affects asset prices. And asset prices for me could be anything from real estate to equities, to bonds, to currencies, to commodities, to credit. So I look at everything across the world, emerging markets and developed countries, and try and piece together the jigsaw puzzle of how movements in those economies will offer opportunities for investment.
And I want to say that one of the things I'm most impressed with is I think you have a very, very honorable process on how you come to conclusions. So I want you to share that with people is, you know, how you make decisions, basically.
Yes. So I operate at a number of different frameworks. One is a secular framework. What is the big trend, the long-term trend? I'm talking 10, 20, 30, 40, 50-year trends. So some of those are relatively easy because demographics is one of the biggest drivers of all. So we can follow the demographic wave and understand what that does to asset prices. You know, that was a big driver of real estate, for example, particularly in 2008 as baby boom generation piled into real estate for their pension plans. It's the big driver of the cheaper end of the market now as millennials try to find homes that are affordable. It's the driver of the expensive part of the real estate market, for example, the larger homes where baby boomers want to sell them and there's less bids around. So that is the long-term theme. We have another big theme within the long-term, which is the global debt bubble, whether that's at central bank level or whether it's at corporate level or whether it's at household level. So I look at those things as well. And, you know, there may be things like the rise of ESG or environmental investing. That will probably end up being a secular theme that drives out over a long period of time, or maybe the decline of the oil business. There's a number of these big things. But the most important thing is the business cycle. That's the ups and downs of an economy. And generally speaking, economists never forecast the ups and downs of economy. They kind of always extrapolate a linear trend. But if you give a small child the graph of GDP in America, it goes up and down. Mm-hmm. And it's cyclical. And we kind of all know that intuitively. But once you're armed with the cyclicality, and you also know that asset prices move up and down with the economy, obviously, then you know that once the cycle rolls over, it's likely to be headed down over a few years, and that asset prices, once the economy starts going negative, asset prices will go negative. And the reverse, when we get to the bottom of the cycle coming up, we can extrapolate forwards the returns of certain asset prices. And then over the top, for trading and positioning, I use chart patterns to help me understand human psychology and where we are in the markets themselves. So that's the general framework. And what I do is, living in the macro world, I have to live in the future. There is no point trying to assess the markets based on the information you know today, because everybody knows it. What you have to do is try and extrapolate out into the future and say, okay, the business cycle is weakening, therefore this will happen. Or right now with the coronavirus, you have to live in the future and see the probabilities. There are no certainties in anything in the investing game, just a probability. So it's assessing those probabilities to figure out what the best opportunity is.
Do you have a team of people and practice sort of a version of idea meritocracy, or do you have kind of meetings with yourself and kind of battle it out to draw conclusions?
So, interestingly enough, because I've been doing this a long time, I have my own thought process. So I do speak to people. I'm very active on Twitter. I'm gathering information. I don't read anybody else's research, really. There's a few research pieces now and then I read, purposely not to corrupt my own thinking. And then I sit down and I write the Global Macro Investor every month, which is about 120 to 130 pages of graphs and words and analysis. And I let that flow to try and figure out myself exactly what's going on. Without coming with a preconception, it's by looking at all of the data and all of the charts and the narratives that are out there to figure out what's going on. So it's actually myself. I have an analyst, Remy Tito, who helps me put together my database of charts and feeds me some of the information, and that's it. I've been doing this for 15 years for Global Macro Investor, and it's just been two of us.
I actually knew that would be your answer because, first of all, I do research in my small little world, and I knew you would do that. I've watched you talk, and it's almost like when you get in front of a chart, it's almost like you're part of the chart. I don't know if you could get inside that chart, you would see a lot more than most people. And for someone that does what I do, I get a big kick out of watching you do that. So I kind of knew that was the answer. One other question regarding...
Well, just to go back on that. I mean, to me, a chart is everything because I understand everything that's gone before and some probabilities of where the future lies. And I got taught this by some of the world's most famous investors like Paul Tudor Jones, Stan Druckenmiller, George Soros. They all use charts. And it just helps you understand where we could be going. And so there's a story in every chart, and that's amazing.
Yeah, in the real estate stuff, I love charts. And, I mean, sometimes I even look at a chart. I've looked at them for 20 years, and then a new explanation comes to me. And my son Aaron, he can tell when I'm really amped about something. It's sort of like a new discovery that cleared up a question. When you're about to put something in writing that's pretty outrageous, because that sometimes happens, before you do that, is there anyone you bounce that off of?
No.
No, okay.
No, because I need people. I mean, I'm in an incredibly flattering position where I get paid very handsomely, and this is outside my role of Real Vision, this is the Global Macro Investor research business, I get paid very handsomely to think independently for others. So I get paid essentially by the world's most famous hedge fund managers, sovereign wealth funds, family offices, asset management firms, to think independently. So that's what they want from me. They want to see things that they don't see. And I don't do it to shock anybody because it's a closed circulation business. It's a very limited number of people are allowed the subscription. It's very expensive. But the point being is I need to be unfettered to allow my own thought process to evolve. They may choose to reject it, but they want to hear the counter argument to their own existing views. So, it's not, in my world, it's not that people need to slavishly follow me. I mean, I've got, very luckily, a very good track record over the 15 years, probably, I don't know, one of the best of all of the kind of research businesses. But, call that luck. But, people are happy to say, listen, I don't agree with you. I'm doing the opposite trade, but I really appreciate understanding where my risks lie.
Now, bringing it to the current, because I wanted to discuss that first so people would understand that I feel like you have a lot of credibility in your process. And so, when we start talking about bringing this to the current situation, I want people to understand you're not given to outrageous statements. These are very calculated words that you come up with, and some of these might be scary today. So that's kind of why I did that.
Okay.
Interesting things going on right now. Probably 6 months ago, you were looking at the charts and came to a conclusion we were probably headed to a recession. Was that just in the United States, or was that a global slowdown?
It was a global slowdown. So the United States kind of pricked the bubble by raising interest rates, even though they didn't go up a lot. But people in the real estate market know that it put on the squeeze on several people because the rate of change of interest rates was quite high. So that started slowing down the economy. Then we had trade tariffs. Trade tariffs were a global event, and we also had a strong dollar, which was pressuring global economies. So the global economy, I thought, was already headed into recession. World trade was negative. And before the coronavirus hit, we already saw German exports falling apart, German manufacturing falling apart, and we could see some elements of some accelerating weakness in the global economy. So that's where I was coming at before all of this.
Before the coronavirus, what kind of a recession did you think would unfold?
Look, we don't know. My base case was mild with a risk of something bad because we have a large problem with the baby boom generation hitting retirement age. The average age of a baby boomer in the United States is 66. They have to, as they go into retirement, they are overweight risk assets, equities and credit. They have to sell those to realize their retirement income. And I thought that that was going to create some problems. The other side of the equation was there was an enormous amount of credit issued by corporations that was also held in their pension plans. And I thought that there was a risk in a recession that credit spreads could widen or credit was harder to get, and that would cause a big problem. So I've been shouting from the rooftops. We did a whole series on Real Vision about the retirement crisis, trying to get people up to speed on the risk they're taking and what is likely to come. So I feared something bigger than a mild recession. My base case was mild. My fear was, you know, a 2008-style event. Then the coronavirus came along. My base case is a 2008 or worse event. And my fear, with a high probability, is actually a depression.
Yeah, that's a heavy word. When in the past
it is, and I don't take it lightly either.
Oh, I know that. That's. I'm going to ask you this. When is the last time? What other cycle, if ever, have you used that word as a projection?
Never.
That's what I thought.
Never.
Okay. Ay. Okay. Now this is definitely.
Let me explain why.
Shall
I explain why a little bit why I think that?
Yes, of course.
You see, if you saw so China did something dramatic. They saw the virus. They saw that its rate of spreading, its RO, was incredibly high. And they saw that it overwhelmed their medical system. And also the death rate was high enough to offer concern. If you use the framework of the rate of the virus spread plus the death rate and look back at the Spanish flu and say, okay, that is what a worst case unconstrained virus looks like. It would have killed the equivalent of 68 million people this time. So China did what they had to do, which was completely shut down the economy to control the virus. And as we've seen, the virus spread in China has collapsed because they took the hardest measure of all, which was basically to collapse their economic growth, take the maximum economic pain with no output, no consumption, and no supply to contain the virus for the sake of society. So South Korea and Singapore did similar, but Italy, Iran were too late. So now they're all shutting down their economies, but this virus has gone to a pandemic. And what happens is one economy after the other is going to have to shut down entirely. That means no factory output, no demand for goods. We've never, ever faced a global demand and supply shock at the same time before. Now, at this point, I'm not extrapolating into the future. I'm talking about what happened yesterday in Italy. They just shut down.
Yeah.
So, and Spain is going to have to follow suit, and France, and Germany, and Denmark, and the United States. And the United States has been the slowest of all at dealing with the spread of the virus. And they have no choice because their voters are baby boomers. And this virus is like a nuclear warhead because it kills baby boomers at a higher rate than it kills anybody else. So the death rate is much higher for the voting population that happens to own all the wealth. So this is why this is an extremely concerning situation. And we are living with hope that maybe the virus dies off in summer, hope that maybe economies can get to grips with this fast enough. But the reality is it doesn't look like they are. So that is my fear here, is that if they do not get control of this in the next 3 weeks, then we have something that is a lot longer lasting, a lot more pervasive, and a lot more destructive as it starts to unwind the big secular bubbles of debt, the equity bubble, the retirement crisis, and also exacerbate the dollar going exploding higher because there's a huge dollar shortage. So that's right, my fear is on all of those things.
That's a lot to consider. So, I mean, as we've used that word black swan event, and is this the mother of them all?
It is. I've heard people warn about pandemics before. Even Bill Gates warned about it, and I didn't get it. I didn't get it. But the moment I saw this, I got it in seconds. Just luckily from experience, I just extrapolated out into the future. But nobody would have thought that we'd have a demand and a supply shock at the same time. Throw in an OPEC oil war in the middle of it, trade tariffs, a US election. I mean, this is like the worst case possible outcome we could have ever, ever established. And we are now kind of praying for a miracle that it doesn't turn into the depression and it's just a 2 or 3 quarter terrible recession like 2008 or a bit worse.
What's crazy about this is a month ago, this wasn't on, well, maybe not that short time ago, but very short time ago, this wasn't even on anybody's radar.
Nope, because we'd had the swine flu, that was okay. We'd had the Ebola virus, we got through that. We'd had the MERS one. So everyone was like, look, you know, we don't need to worry about these things. We have one after another.
Yeah.
You know, living in the Caribbean, I live in the Cayman Islands, you kind of know it with hurricanes. People have lived here long enough know you get missed by hurricanes every year, and it's like, oh, that's okay. But that just means the probability is increasing that you're going to get another big one soon. But people didn't see that, and I didn't see it. Even I didn't really understand what the risks truly were. But this is going to change people's psyche forever on this stuff.
Well, I mean, when they closed Italy, that changed my serious outlook of it. I thought, okay, that's a shocker right there. And then, okay, no basketball. And all of a sudden you really start realizing, okay, we've never dealt with anything like this, at least in my lifetime.
Well, I've gone back in history and I can't find another time in all history where we've dealt with anything like this. We've never taken measures. Nobody's ever shut economies before. Not rolling shutdowns, one economy after another, city by city. It's never happened.
When I look at charts today, I just scanned them before I come on air with you. And, you know, naturally I knew the stock market was going to take a hit, but gold's taking a hit, silver's taking a hit, Bitcoin's taking a hit. There doesn't seem to be a safe haven right at the moment.
So even bonds aren't moving much anymore. I think there is a huge liquidation going on from hedge funds, asset management firms. You know, if you think about the standard pension portfolio of 60-40 stocks versus equities, or 70-30 is more likely these days. Well, the idea was that bonds would protect you when equities fell. The problem is bonds have just had this huge rally, and they're almost pricing in zero rates. So there's not much more they can move. So you don't get price gains out of bonds. You get a bit more left maybe, but not much. So no price gains from bonds. That means all the pension plans are holding too much equities. So there becomes liquidation events from everybody in this. The overlevered hedge funds, there's a number of players. So they sell anything they can, anything that's not nailed down, they sell to pay margin calls until they sort their portfolios out. And that's kind of what's happening to gold. That's exactly what's happening to Bitcoin.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. The psychological impact of this on not only investors, but companies. What what are the ramifications that we've just gone through? What does that cause?
Well, just think at a societal level. Again, you haven't yet got it in the US, but very soon everyone's going to understand that everyone's going to fear each other. I mean, that is truly extraordinary. We've only seen that level of fear in the United States, probably in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina. But when people fear each other, that is this kind of scarring. People fear going into public, fear socializing with people, fear going to music concerts or anything like that. So that has an ongoing effect. Also, a lot of this consumption is gone forever. It's not pent-up demand. It just kind of disappears forever. And so, you know, to be able to get through this is very difficult for many people. I mean, I feel truly worried for people who own restaurants and shops and bars and simple things that require people to go and visit them. I mean, it's a catastrophic event because they're going to get quarantined. All their staff are going to go home and they've got full payroll plus rent to pay and no income. Most businesses probably can't last 2 months. So, you know, that's what I fear is going to come out the other side of this is really something quite ugly. And again, you know, if there's a lot of real estate investors listening to this, then they need to understand that the likelihood of people not paying their rent, particularly businesses, is extremely high. People, less so. Yes, people are going to lose jobs, and that will be the knock-on effect behind that. But, you know, people are at home, being paid, working from home, not spending much on other stuff. So, you know, if you're renting out apartments and stuff, that's less of an issue. But if you're renting out to retail, you've got a huge problem on your hands.
Yeah, I started thinking about those dominoes last night, actually. I saw a video in Italy, and they were in line for something, and they were about 5 feet apart. And that was very interesting, the space. So this line took up an enormous amount of length just because they were so separated. And then whoever was on the recording said that there's a law in place now that if you get closer than 3 feet to somebody, you can be arrested and put in jail for 90 days.
Yeah, that's how serious this is.
Yeah, that's really serious. So if we could just go quickly through the dominoes of a stock market declining and how that impacts corporate debt. And then if the corporate debt starts to have defaults, what does that cause?
Yeah, okay. I call this the doom loop. So let me tell you about the virtuous loop that preceded it. The virtuous loop was corporations in America had a ridiculous tax break that allowed them to issue debt and buy back their shares, and it was advantageous for them. That drives their share price higher, obviously, because there's less shares in existence. So the management issued themselves stock options, and they all got rich, and the shareholders applauded because the share price went up. But the reality was they were switching equity for debt. Okay, so that's one side of the equation. What drove those corporations was low interest rates. Great, we've still got those. And it's also corporate cash flows. Companies were making record profits and high cash flow, so they could afford to service debt. On the other side of the virtuous circle was the pension plans, particularly at state level, places like Illinois and New Jersey, which didn't have enough money to meet the promises they've made to retirees, to the firemen and the teachers and all of those kind of guys. So what they did is they raised taxes and started injecting that tax money into these pension plans, which was, okay, a good idea. Yes, people have kind of double paid for their pensions, but it's going to help them in retirement. And that was being used to buy corporate credit. So the debt that these companies were issuing was being bought by these, and that was okay. But then it got worse because the corporations kept going and kept going and kept going. So they, in fact, became the only buyer of equities in the United States. Basically, the entire pension system was selling because of the baby boomers. Younger people weren't buying stocks. And the pension plans overall, as I said, they were all divesting. So the only buyer was the corporation. And they were issuing more and more debt, which was being pushed into the corporate pension plan. But while these companies were issuing more debt, their credit ratings were getting downgraded. So they all ended up, these big companies, $4 trillion of the debts in a number of companies were in the triple B tier, which is the one tier below junk bonds. Now, why that's significant is if they got downgraded to junk bonds, they are not able to be held by the pension plans. They have to go to junk bond buyers, which is a much smaller pool. So that would completely freeze up junk bonds. As you go into recession like now, companies like Ford, General Motors, stuff like that, the risk of them getting downgraded explodes. So the credit market starts seizing. But then the worst part happens, the doom loop. The doom loop is when corporate cash flows go negative. So the corporations now don't have the capital to buy back their shares, to service the debt to buy back more shares. So they stop. That means the largest buyer of equities in the building has just left. So on the other side of the doom loop is the credit guys. Well, if you remember, I told you the tax receipts were what was buying the credit for these pension plans. Well, tax receipts are also driven by the business cycle. So when the business cycle goes negative, as it is now, then tax receipts stop. There's a bit of a lag, then they stop. When tax receipts stop, there's no buyer of credit left in the world. So you basically have a situation where there is no buyers of equities, no buyers of credit, and the risk of all of these gigantic corporations as triple Bs getting downgraded. That is one of the most concerning situations I've ever seen. The reason why it's so concerning to me is because all of these assets, the equities and the credit, is basically held by a bunch of 66-year-olds who are about to retire or who have just retired. So they're taking an extraordinary amount of risk considering how old they are. And I fear that they're going to see their retirement savings entirely wiped out.
There was a movie, The Big Short. There were people that bet against the outcome of other people's investments in the mortgage-backed security world. Are there bets against the outcome of corporate bonds?
Well, you know, yes, there are. You know, there's HYG, which is the high-yield index. You can buy puts on that, or LQD, which is an ETF on investment grade. You can buy puts on that. The problem is they were never as cheap as the bet we saw in The Big Short.
Okay.
So that was an extraordinarily cheap bet. But yes, there are bets, and there are plenty of people playing the blow-up in credit spreads. Part of that trade was being long bonds, but that's almost played its way out now,
right,
and there's less juice in the trade. Being short the stock market obviously is all part of the same doom loop. And then being short or buying puts on stuff like HYG as an ETF.
AIG was the bag holder in 2008. Is there one particular bag holder in 2020?
I think it's the entire pension system.
Uh-oh.
And so I think the Fed will have to support the pension system, because you cannot renege on so many people at the same time. There's 76 million baby boomers. You just cannot renege on them all in one go. So there is if there is a duty of government, it's this. It's not to do quantitative easing to help the financial institutions. It's to inject capital or guarantee the pension system.
When you say the Fed, are you saying the U.S. government or the Fed? I mean, or the Federal Reserve?
It's the Federal Reserve, for the stability of the financial system. Whether it's done in cahoots with the government, because in times of crisis, there is no separation really between the Fed and the government, I don't know. We're seeing that in Europe now, that the government and the ECB, the governance and the ECB are kind of going to have to tie together, because the next phase is printing money to pay for fiscal stimulus at each individual country level. So we're going to change the rule book shortly.
Fed's going to have a meeting. Before the meeting, they lowered interest rates by a half. What do you think the market reaction to that was?
Well, look, the bond market's already pricing another 100 basis points of cuts. So unless they deliver that this week or next, the market's going to crash even further. So it's fully priced in. I mean, rates are going to zero regardless, and they have to do it ultra fast.
You've also definitely not been a fan of negative interest rates for the U.S. So are we headed there? And if we do, what's the impact?
We don't know, really. You know, they've been running in Europe and Japan for a long time, and it didn't affect the man on the street, because if you can pay for storage of your money and it's safe, you'd rather that. So, you know, people will pay 2% a year. I mean, people pay to have their gold stored. So I don't, you know, yes, it creates weird things where corporations can borrow at negative rates, but it's all about the safety of money. Look, we're pushing our system to its limits, and I think it's going to break in all of this. Can we go to negative interest rates? For sure. You know, but what we're trying to do at this point is prop up the final remnants of a system that has now gone wrong. And it's mainly driven by the baby boomers who built all the debt and created this kind of disinflationary, deflationary environment that has made it so hard. And so in the end of this, I think we have to find some different answer. We can't use the same financial market construct, because it won't absorb the baby boomers moving out of the capital markets.
And what would that be?
I think it's Bitcoin. I think it's Bitcoin and the whole digital asset world. So yes, gold plays a part in this for sure, always has, always will. But I think if you're going to construct a new digital world, it has to be digital. And I think we've already heard from the central banks that they desperately have to get off the dollar funding, the dollar plumbing. It's not so much the dollar itself, but the plumbing is causing so much problem that they're going to switch to digital currencies. That allows an on-ramp and an off-ramp, allowing people with Bitcoin to transact between two, i.e. you can pay your taxes easily from one to the other. So that appeases governments. We've seen Facebook building the Libra coin, which is like an SDR, special depository receipt, for as a global currency. We're seeing Bitcoin, Ethereum. We're seeing all of the developments and the applications all across the financial world. I've never seen a greater hive mind of the smartest people in the world all developing thousands of parts of the financial system at the same time. And not only the financial system, the kind of system of notarization or verification or trust or ownership or transfer, all of this is being built in front of our eyes. I mean, it's incredible. And everyone knows it's a race. It's a race to get this built out. So the only way to play it easily for people is Bitcoin, which is plummeting currently, but is offering very soon a very, very good opportunity to have a call option on a different world.
Okay. Raul, I think I'll end it there. I know you're going to have so many calls today for your time, and I appreciate taking time to share with our audience what you thought, and also your credibility in that I can say, when this gentleman says depression, he would not say that word lightly, and apparently never has said it in any other situation. So I really appreciate you taking time to join us today.
Not at all. And I urge people to go and check out Real Vision, which is our video on demand business.
Absolutely.
Which really is the best single source of kind of truthiness in financial markets you'll find anywhere. We don't really do news. We do the analysis that you actually need to understand what's going on. And we've got the best people in the world best hedge fund managers, analysts, strategists. It's kind of not what you would see as financial television. This is like the thing you absolutely must have. And as we all get sent home from work and we'll be working from home, watching stuff like Real Vision really helps. And you can just go to realvision.com. There's a free version of it, so you can watch free videos. Or if not, it's $1 for a trial for 30 days. And it's ridiculously inexpensive compared to the value it's going to add to everybody.
And especially the audience that we have, it's taught me a lot about a broad range of investing. And you introduced me to so many people through that program. And by the way, when you interview them, I can tell you guys know each other like you're friends, which is pretty neat to watch.
Yeah, look, it's an amazing thing. I mean, I'm lucky. I know a lot of people from my career, and you know, a lot of these very famous investors who would never appear anywhere else appear in Real Vision. But the mission was to give access to these kind of people at the very heart of the financial system that the average guy would never get access to. We're now giving them open access. I mean, it's a game changer for somebody who really wants to understand what's going on. So you're not listening to your financial advisor. You're not reading a headline in a newspaper or watching something on CNBC. You're actually getting somebody with skin in the game who really knows what's going on, explaining it to you.
Yep. Fantastic website. Okay, Raul, have a great day. Thanks again for joining us.
Yep, thanks okay. very much. Very All much right. enjoyed it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.